Hey, y'all, if you enjoy watching your podcast, which seems kind of weird, watching your podcast, but some people really enjoy that. So we have a YouTube channel. You can find it at Heather Parady, P-A-R-A-D-Y. It's also linked up in the show notes. You can hit subscribe. And several of these interviews are actually in person, so you can watch that. Again, that is at Heather Parady on YouTube. Tony Watley is the founder of 365 Driven and is passionate about helping business owners achieve their wildest dreams. With over 20 years of experience as an entrepreneur, he's built and sold multiple companies for millions of dollars. He leads a community of over 4,000 business owners, is an executive and business coach, and keynote speaker. But listen, before you dismiss him as some business guru, Tony Watley also makes content like this.
I want a Rolls Royce, but I drive a Jeep. So I started researching influencers that drive a Rolls Royce to learn their mindset and behaviors. I came up with a plan to immerse myself and visualize owning one. At first, it felt uncomfortable to do the Rolls Royce lean, but after a few miles, it started to have a positive effect on me. I began to feel my status increase. I felt like I had more power, more authority. I became obsessed with this feeling. I decided to take this beyond just driving. The Rolls-Royce lean made me feel stronger, almost as if I was invincible. But I also fear that this obsession with status and power has clouded my judgment.
I've known Tony for a while, and I love his heart for people and especially the underdog. But as he's been rolling out more entertaining, humorous, outside-of-the-box content, I'm like, what's this dude doing? I'll tell you what, he is breaking the mold of what content creation and creativity can look like in the entrepreneurial space. So I brought him on in to talk about how to bring fun, humor, creativity to your content. How to get over the self-consciousness, insecurity of being yourself online. And why Tony thinks we're all living in the Matrix.
The thing about ego is that if we achieve success at some level in something, or it's a skill or a hobby, just something we become known as successful at or an authority in, it's very hard for people at that level to become an amateur or a rookie or a noob.
Yes.
At something new. We do not admire things within other people that are not within us. Understand that. If we admire characteristics or habits that other people have, we have that within us.
Well, that was the most deep ass question response I've ever gotten. Tony Watley, thank you again for jumping on my podcast. I would say, I'm not going to say it. I'm going to keep doing this. It's probably going to be a thing where you're like, good God, girl, how many times are you going to interview me? But if I get a chance and an opportunity, I love your work. I love your heart for people. I love that you are breaking the mold from what I see other successful entrepreneurial businessmen do. You don't act like everybody else does, and it just makes you stick out above the noise. I have a bunch of serious ass questions for you and a few weird ones. But Tony Watley, thanks for joining us again.
Well, you almost set me up where improv was about to kick in and I was going to start acting like guru influencer. Yeah, let's go. Come on, Heather. Thank you for having me on the show, Heather. This is amazing. Yeah, I'm just doing it.
Yeah, we've had those. We've had those. I'm curious. Let's just jump straight the hell into this. I'm going to link up all of our previous interviews we've done together. People have already heard your bio. If they want to go deeper into your story, look in the show notes and I'll have links to our previous episodes. But to cut straight to the chase, you are a successful businessman who over 20 years experience in the entrepreneurial space building things. You are confident. You roll with people who have done big things in this world. And what has been so interesting to me about you, and I'm a little confused, is there has emerged over the past, I would say, couple of years, this kind of humorous, entertaining Tony out of what seems like nowhere. And maybe I just didn't really know you before, but it seems like you're just as much of the motivational business content. You've actually been making the kind of content of folks that I know who are in the entertainment space, the stuff that they're doing, you're doing. Is that an intentional decision and shift, or was that always you and Heather just doesn't pay it a freak attention?
It is a very intentional shift, and it goes back to when I started making content. It was 2017, and you have heard the story about how I was in the car accident, and I basically hid from the cameras and things like that. Even when I'm looking at the screen, you can see why I have vitiligo. I'm covered with white spots. And so my entire life, I just hid from the cameras, and I've always been very competitive, and I've always done a lot of things winning in the background and building these companies and hiding behind the company logos. And I never felt comfortable putting myself out there on the spotlight or a microphone or a stage. I was like, that's just not for me. I'll be back here. Because when you grow up with a skin condition that's very prevalent, people are always asking you, what's wrong with you? And I got tired of answering the question. I've always had confidence, but you know, if you didn't know me, like, people would always ask, and it kind of got uncomfortable for a while. And so I just figured the best way to not be asked is to not, you know, put myself out there. I also think about when I started making content, some of the people that I'd known actually cared about, because I care about a lot of people, like you said, most of the people, they didn't understand why I was doing what I was doing. And some of them actually kind of came like these little passive aggressive critics and saying like, what are you trying to be, Tony Robbins? Like, you want to be a motivational speaker? And I'm like, oh, and I even had one guy that I worked with at a pretty large oil company, like, send me a DM and LinkedIn and saying like, you're just trying to become a grifter and take advantage of people and, you know, hurt business owners. And the funny thing about this, Heather, is like, he never even knew that I had businesses. He only knew me from working as a project manager in oil and gas with him. And so in his mind, like, I was doing a 360, 180 degree change to go do something I had no experience in. And, you know, the fact that he would send that kind of message when we actually had a really good working relationship. And so where I'm going back with this is back in 2017 and 18, I had a lot of anger and resentment for some of these people that were still a part of my life at that time, because I had helped these people. We'd been on vacations with them. I'd helped them build vehicles and get sponsorships and make money and given them advice. And why couldn't they support me? You know? And so I was very angry when I first hit the scene and the content. And a lot of the things I had were me trying to figure out myself and being comfortable in front of a camera. And that kind of translated the way I was a little bit more direct and a little bit more stern. And I think you probably caught the tail end of that phase when we kind of crossed paths. And that was my content. I was serious, but more direct. I've always been compassionate, but I was direct. And I dropped a lot more F-bombs back then. I know I was aware of that. And so as I've evolved and I started to become more confident on camera and on stages and things like that, doing my own internal work and not seeking the external validation, but realizing that my intention is the right reason that I'm doing this, my content started to shift back to where I truly am. Yes, I'm very competitive when we're competing, but I'm also, I love humor and I love telling jokes and I like making people laugh and feel good. Yeah. And so that started to show up more. And also the automotive type themes and content started to show up more in recent years, because I realized that, I'm going into this personal development space. And yes, I've built very successful automotive performance businesses, but I had to test myself to make sure that I wasn't just stealing the audience from my past and trying to bring them forward, because I wasn't doing anything like I was doing before. And so I wanted to make sure that the content and the message that I created could stand on its own two legs. And then once I saw that it did, and I had a good two solid years of results in all different industries with different business owners, that's when I started to say, okay, I am a car guy. Let me start to introduce some of these car topics and car themes and car content back into my life. And so those two things did make a shift.
Good. I'm glad you brought up kind of the insecurity piece. And I know that's like a regurgitated message in anybody who ever talks about content. But I would argue that when you shift, not putting out content's intimidating, but then when you start leaning into comedy and or any kind of storytelling element, any kind of creative thing, I feel like there's an extra layer there of insecurity that comes in, because I don't know about you, I feel pretty comfortable kind of in this setting, or I've, you know, talked on stage before and as Heather Parody, and I have never felt so insecure and small and shaking in my girl boots than my first acting class, where there was 8 people there and I had to stand on stage and do a monologue. Like, it was horrible. And I'm like, where is this coming from? I'm a confident woman, like eight people. But that creative side, showing it, there was such a sense of vulnerability in that that I never really experienced, even in putting out content. And I'm curious with you if you feel similar to that. And if so, what do you think it is about the creative stuff that's so freaking scary?
I used to have stage fright, and I didn't realize that until I stood up in a conference and answered a question to the speaker that was on stage. He made me stand up, and he's like, "Oh, stand up. Hey, get this guy a microphone," the whole thing, 1,000 people. It was an audience that was not mine. I didn't know anybody in that room. It was actually a different industry that I'd came from. And that was the first time I felt real stage fright. And I had all the physiological signs, the cotton mouth. I started getting sweat droplets on the top of my head. Felt like I ate a spicy pepper, sweaty palms, heart rate was elevated. You could tell. And I had the shaky voice when I was responding to a question, which I had expertise in. But when I sat down, I was like, wow, I've never experienced that before. And I think that's out of ego, because I built a company with 75 people on staff. I'd led engineering teams with hundreds of people and international projects, hundreds of millions of dollars. And I was always confident being the boss, being the leader, and doing the pep rallies and the project kickoff meetings and selling and closing on some very, very big deals, like in the corporate space. But when you start to realize that that's not public speaking skill, because that's a captive audience. When you're the boss or you're the supervisor and you're occasionally having the confidence to say things in front of people, that's not the same thing as trying to be an entertainer. It's trying to help, you know, people that don't know you, right? Because when people don't know you, they can get up and go take a piss break and leave the room or start looking at their phone if you're not keeping them engaged. So I had to learn those skills. And for me, I think going through Toastmasters early on made me very comfortable with speaking in front of people that I knew, because when you go to these Toastmasters meetings, it's largely the same people every week. So you get used to speaking in front of people that you know, and that gives you a little more confidence and support. And so I got used to doing that. But where it shifted again for me is when I did improv school. And that was a whole thing. I know you and I, we can talk about that, but there's a difference between improv and public speaking.
100%.
So the improv thing for me was difficult, because when we're going through a Toastmasters or working with a public speaking coach, we are refining our delivery. We're refining ourselves as a character. We understand how we would like to communicate, and we start to build that character. And when you see me on stage, I'm very intense, but I like to keep people on an emotional journey up and down. And so that's the character I was building with public speaking that I still use. That's who I am on stage. The comedy thing is completely different, because there's no character building, because you're assigned a character as soon as you step onto that stage by whoever's out there. And so I always kind of joke about, like, I've had to play a sexy 85-year-old grandma on stage, how they communicate, how they would walk, how they would interact with other people. And so all that practice you did in public speaking of building your character has nothing to do with improv comedy.
Yeah. What principles, I mean, obviously I know you do your sketches, which are awesome. I'll link up your IG, your Facebook in the show notes. What principles in the entertainment space do you wish people would adopt more in content creation? Now, maybe they're not wanting to do what you and I want to do, or we're taking classes and auditioning and doing some crazy stuff. But if we could take some of those entertainment storytelling principles that you've extracted from your classes and what you've been playing with over the past few years, what do you see you wish, what do you wish more entrepreneurials were doing in their content?
I'm going to reframe this as, what do I see people that are doing that aren't getting results? Because this will speak to a lot more people, because, man, I like to support everybody in my groups and the people that we interact with. You and I, we always interact with each other's comments and content, and we see people, 20, 30 people that we kind of follow, and year after year, they're not getting any result. You know, they want to build a personal brand. They're wanting to get on bigger stages. They wouldn't like to have a bigger podcast. They're building things in the influencer space, whether that's for personal brand opportunities or maybe to get some notoriety and increase their business. Like, there's reasons we do these kind of things. And I see so many people just struggling, and they're not really making any traction. They're not getting ahead. And so when you look back, it's because they're not doing that investment in themselves. They're not taking improv comedy to make their comedy on point. They're not learning how to sketch comedy. They're not hiring a speaking coach to help their communication, mm-hmm. all these different things. Like you kind of joked about on our previous recording, your accent, your Southern girl accent, you've actually lost most of that. Just like I have, I'm from Texas. In fact, there's a first time
you
I was on
so?
TV. Yes. And first time I was really? On TV as an interview, it was 2005 at an automotive event. And that clip, if you hear me, I sound like the biggest Texas redneck ever. Yeah, like the whole slur, like, and that's how I spoke until that point. And I started getting awareness. And then you start working with different coaches. They go, hey, you enunciate a little bit better, be a little more crispier, quit saying, man, ah, and all these things that distract people from your message and make you seem less confident. So all these pieces of awareness from mentors who are ahead of you will greatly accelerate the results. So I think people are not investing in their speaking skills, their communication skills, their copy skills when they're writing posts. These are skills. These are not talents. These are all skills that we learned.
Yeah. But people could.
The image part. They're missing the image part. They're not showing up as something that they want. Like they're still hanging out where they're at, but they're not trying to think about, hey, I want to be this. But they're still showing up with who they are today instead of who they want to be.
Tell me more about that. What do you mean by that? Like the image part showing up here? Are you talking about like an alter ego type situation?
I always think about this is that I'm a very future forward mindset type person, and I like to visualize and become who I would like to become. So let's take, for example, at age 39, which I'm 51 now, age 39. Yeah. I had millions in the bank, successful on the financial stuff, but I was also getting flabby and out of shape and just kind of let myself go. And I had all the convenient excuses like, oh, football injury, shoulder, and oh, my left knee is just too sore, I can't run anymore, and oh, that lower back pain. So I was making the same excuses as the friends that were surrounding me at that time. They were all like peaked in high school type athlete guys that were all just dad bod, you know, out of shape, full of excuses, financially check the box guys, right? And so in my mind, I always felt like I was still an athlete at 39, which at that time I felt was so old, but I'm 51 and I'm thinking 39 is pretty young. But every time I looked in the mirror in the morning, I'm in the restroom, I'm looking at myself and I was like, man, I don't look like the way I feel inside. Like I feel like I could still do these sports and I could still do these things, but I'm not looking at what I'm seeing. And so at 39, I took a more serious path of, who do I want to become? I was like, I want to be the guy that's fit at 45, at 50, that takes care of himself, that goes to the gym and actually can still perform in these sports and do these different things and be more active and be able to hike and skateboard and all these different things that I do and power lifting and stuff. And so I just took a different approach. Who do I want to become? And I started to think and operate and eat and behave like that person, even though I know I wasn't there. Realistic. I'm not delusional, but when you're building a character or a persona online, think about things that you admire. What are the characteristics and people that you admire? Like the content that you create, Heather, you admire certain characteristics, whether that's visual or how they act or how they communicate or how they think. We do not admire things within other people that are not within us. Understand that. If we admire characteristics or habits that other people have, we have that within us. It's just we haven't learned to extract that and showcase it yet. So whatever things you're listening to is like you're checking the boxes, like I admire that person for this and I admire that person for that. You have that within you. You just haven't learned to extract it yet. So you have to start thinking about who do I want to become, let's say 3 years from now. Not really long, 3 years from now. How does that person show up in public? How does that person communicate? How's that person dress? If you don't like the way you dress, like change that. That's the easiest thing to change. How do you carry yourself? What's your confidence level? What's your level of knowledge? Because you're reading enough content and learning from people to understand things. Like if you can gamify, like that's who I want to become. The paths are already there. Like, you know how to get there. You just have to start thinking and acting like that person today, making the decisions, and inevitably you will become that person.
I'm curious. I heard you say somewhere else that you grew up around rich kids, but you weren't rich yourself. And the first thing you said that in passing, and the first thing I thought was, well, that's who he rolls with now. Like, he's in that crowd now. He is around wealthy folks, and, you know, huge theme of your content is getting people to achieve the success that you've experienced. And I'm curious, we talk about this identity piece. What have you learned about the rich, the successful, if we were to look at them objectively, now that you're in that world, what have you learned about those folks that you didn't understand before? And the reason I'm asking this is I think there's a persona, and I know in my mind, if I grew up poor too, of like what it means to be successful in that world, and looking at you and how free you are, you're skateboarding and you're doing sketches and you're fully being seen, and you roll with like some tough dudes who like, boom, you know what I mean? And there seems like there's a contrast there, but maybe I'm wrong and I have a prejudice that is incorrect. And I'm curious, now that you're in that world, what is it actually like?
Yeah, context for the growing up without money thing. My parents, dad's a Vietnam combat vet. So yeah, after he got out of the Marines, he came back to Houston area because that's where his parents lived at the time. So we lived with my grandparents. My mom's a Japanese immigrant, so she came back over with him, with me and my sister. And so they made it a point to get into a very good public school system because they understood the value of education, especially my mom. Like, she didn't get the full education being a woman, baby boomer generation in Japan. They got basically a junior high level education. The boys got to go into high school and college. So she always valued education because that wasn't given to her. So they found a good suburb of Houston, which is Friendswood, Texas. It's still one of the top ranked public schools in the entire country. It always does really well on those standardized metrics. And they said, man, that's an expensive place to live, but we'll go just buy a house that we can afford. And I think the first house we lived in was maybe a 1200 square foot fixer upper that just looked like total crap. But that's how it was. The first three houses I grew up with, the same school district, we'd get a little bit older, they would sell the first house that we would refurbish ourselves. We're living in these houses and we're stripping carpet, we're pulling off wallpaper. We're four of us, the family, are restoring these houses. We didn't hire contractors because we didn't have money. Did that three times. So the first three houses were basically what most people would call a flip house. We lived in those and we flipped those as we lived in them. So that's the kind of neighborhood that I grew up in. It was always the crappiest house in the crappiest neighborhood. We just get a little bit bigger one down the block.
Right.
But I'm surrounded by these people who are upper middle class generally in the school district. And in fact, like, to give you an idea, the high school, the parking lot for the students was all these brand new fancy cars. Back then it was Mustang GTs and IROC Camaros and Corvettes. Like, the student lot was fancier than the faculty lot by far. It wasn't even a comparison. So that kind of gives you an idea. Like, the kids have nicer cars than the faculty. Yeah. Like, that's how it was. And I never had any resentment for that, but it kind of motivated me to realize like there was more to life. And I remember being a kid riding my bicycle around at these big fancy neighborhoods that were just a couple miles away. And I would pause and look at some of these houses, Heather, and they were so big and they always had extra cars in the driveway. And so that allowed me to realize that this actually exists. It wasn't just something I saw on TV. It's like, it's right there. Like, something had to happen for that to be a result. And the houses I grew up with at the time had two windows on the front. One was in my sister's bedroom, so I couldn't go in that one. The other one was the front window of the house. So I had two windows in the front of the house. And I remember standing in that front window watching my sister get on the bus when I was too young to get on and just waving at her out the window. And when I started to see these big houses that had all these windows, I imagined myself running through that house and getting a different view out of all these different windows. That's how small I was thinking. You know, I was like, I would just like to see what it looks like to look out of that window and then that window and that window. And so I always was around the kids, and I knew that the kids weren't the rich ones. It was the parents. And so I was always curious, and I would go to dinners or birthday parties or sleepovers. And I would always ask the parents sincerely, what do you do for a living? Not how much money do you make? Cause that was pretty obvious that they were making more than we were, but I would ask, what did you do for a living? What do you do for a living? And I started to realize even early on that 9 out of 10 of those people that were wealthy or business owners, they weren't working for somebody else. I was like, oh, and I started to figure that out even when I was in high school. And so I realized, like, man, I'm never going to get rich working for somebody. I need to go create a business. I don't know what that means, but I'll figure it out later. Right. So you ask the question, what do I learn now kind of being in that circle? I think that there's a lot of successful people who have not stepped into personal development space. And I'm speaking as someone who did this. I sold my first company. I was 34. I was relatively young. I wasn't all in on personal development. I'd read some books and, you know, I became a multimillionaire, and it sounds like douchey to say that. I became that kind of just operating and doing things the right way. I didn't understand that I was doing things the right way. I just had a guiding principle to do things the right way. I never want to half-ass things. Even though it was a side business, I treated it like a legit business, and I did the right things, and I adopted systems and processes and leadership and core values and things that we had borrowed from the corporate world. And so I didn't understand the company was worth that much. It sold for millions. And I was like, oh, that was a life-changing thing. But I didn't have all the knowledge of why. I didn't understand why the company is worth that much. It just got bought by a private equity company. And so here I am, financially checked the box. And like I said, my mid-30s, I let myself go, and I was, you know, buying fancier shit than I probably should have because I felt insecure about things and I wanted to validate myself and prove that I did something and accomplished it, new money behaviors. And what I learned now is that there's so many people that have checked one of the boxes in life, like the basis of my show, wealth, health, mindset, relationships, those four cornerstones. Most people have checked one of those boxes very well. Maybe they got an amazing relationship, but they're broke and they're unhealthy. Or maybe they're just rich and their terrible relationship and their health is bad. Like, there's always this four-legged table. They're missing a couple legs. Yes, the crowd that I run with now, I'm very aware that I want all four of those legs checked off, but it wasn't always that way. And I realize that even though I'm running with a crowd that's got all four legs checked off, they're a very small percentage of reality out there. Very small. I'd say less than 1% of the people out there. So there's a lot of financially successful people who are just as insecure as everybody else about what they're missing. And they don't have the confidence to talk about that. And they too much of an ego to hire someone to help them fix those other three legs. And so they just have more money. That's the only box they checked off.
I'm going to press in even more, because the reason I asked you that is when you think about shifting your identity from what the cards you've been handed to this ideal self that you want to be, the deliberate intention and focus it takes to get that. Once we get there, sometimes we hold on to that so tightly that we can't adjust from there and grow from there. And give context, I just came back from California. It was a small group of very successful folks in different industries, and kind of the theme of it was creative projects. These are people who have been working their asses off for a long time and built things. Every single person said, man, I have this nudge to write a fiction book or make a film or go into a completely different arena than I've been now. But what happened is you crystallized this successful identity to break out of where you came from. And re-breaking that and being able to be adjustable is interesting to me. And I see you as somebody who's done that very well. Like, you fought and you built something, but you have broken the mold of like, I'm going to be grunty man successful. Like, you're doing fun stuff and reinventing yourself at 51 years old. And not everybody knows how to do that, because I work so hard, Tony, to be this. And now you're telling me that I have to let go of that? What would you respond?
Well, first of all, the next book that I will be publishing is going to be based on reinvention. So I'm glad you kind of cued in on that, because I do lead by example on that. The answer to that question, it all goes back to ego and insecurity. That's the basis of why we get stuck in the routine that we're in.
Yeah.
This is especially true. I think that I'm going to call out the dudes here. I see more men struggle with this than women. I see women are more apt to change and understand that they got to reinvent themselves. And they're more emotionally attached to doing that versus trying to resist doing that. Mm. Where a man usually goes out in the world and they try to define themselves in success. And one of those four legs I talked about on the table, health, wealth, mindset, relationships. And so maybe you become the fitness guy and everybody respects you because you're super jacked and you know all the supplements and the training routines and all the stuff, right? But then you don't have any money and you're like, well, I'm just super successful at this. And they go, well, why don't you figure out how to build a company and learn how to monetize that. And they're like, well, yeah, I don't need to do that. I'm a trainer. I make a lot of money doing what I do. I love what I do. And so the thing about ego is that if we achieve success at some level in something, or it's a skill or a hobby, just something we become known as successful at or an authority in, it's very hard for people at that level to become an amateur or a rookie or a noob.
Yes.
At something new. And
yes,
they believe through ego that it's a lateral move. Like, if I'm good at this and I go do this new thing, I should be perceived the same level as this. And if you need evidence of that, it kind of starts to show up as people who are perfectionists, who don't want to show any negative side of things or beginner level stuff. And so you got people out there that will go have genuine interest in a new hobby or new skill, but they won't mention it. They won't mention that until they've built some level of confidence and expertise, yes, in that. Then they finally start to showcase that. And yes, that's a huge mistake, because most people never really achieve that level that they would be happy for themselves. And so they quit too early, way too early, before they ever get that result. And no one ever knows that they even tried. And that's why, because they're worried about judgment. They have insecurities and they're perceived as an expert at this over here. So why would they want to go make themselves look like a rookie over here? And I think that's one of the things I'm exceptional at, is I'm willing to go suck at things and show people that I suck at things. And I'm okay with that, because I don't think I'm entitled to being held as a status or authority in some different thing that I'm new at. But also, part of my content creation, my personal branding, is that I'm going to go do things that are challenging. I'm going to show you that I'm going to suck and I'm going to fall down a lot, but I'm going to keep getting back up. Yeah. And if you keep watching me long enough, you'll start to see the improvements over time, and you'll start to believe in what's possible for yourself, because you've seen me go from suck to expert at something many times. But that's the journey I like to take people on, because I want people to start believing in themselves.
Do you ever get embarrassed that first post of trying something new? Is there ever a hesitation or some kind of
I used to have that for sure. Like when I was talking about not being comfortable being on stage or cameras, for sure. But nowadays, no. And I think that there's a reason that we put out comedy. You and I put out comedy. We've become okay being laughed at. Like it's funny. I mean, some of the best stuff out there is just blooper reels and the things that get cut out of movies, but be okay being laughed at. I think if you take yourself too seriously, that's where your ego kind of puts the guard up. Like, I'm super serious, successful guy. I can't be laughed at. I got to take myself super serious all the time. And guys, if you're acting like that, people are laughing at you just behind your back.
Amen to that. What is your goal with kind of more the entertainment side to stuff? Are you trying to do different kind of marketing stuff in the business realm, or do you have any ambition for doing anything in the entertainment space?
Yes, I will eventually do some stand-up comedy. That's something that I work on. I'll do that. I'm not scared of doing that. That's just public speaking in a different format. It's actually easier than public speaking to me, because you're still writing out the jokes. You're still practicing the jokes. And most comedians you talk to, and I've interviewed a few of them, they'll tell you they're not really that funny in person. Like, everybody thinks a comedian is just always making people laugh and like center of the party, but they're usually introverts, which I am.
Yes.
And they practice the jokes and they build a repertoire of jokes that have proven to land. And that's how a comedy goes. I think improv is actually more scary than stand up, because you never know what's going to happen on that stage. So I think that that's something that I'll enjoy going to do. I wish there was a better comedy clubs here in the Houston area, but there's really not. There's only like a couple, and they're, you know, if it was something more interesting with open mic nights, I would probably do something like that. But I also use that comedy type content in my public speaking now. That was one of the reasons I did that, because I like to have the crowd work and I like to react to things that somebody's phone goes off, or you know, you're going to answer that, you know, like you're quicker with things versus like feeling like, oh, it's disrupting me. And like, it's getting me off of my line. I can't stay motivational because something outside of my control is happening. Right.
Yeah.
So comedy, I think, definitely movies. I've been an extra in a few different movies and TV things, and that's kind of fun, but I don't know if I'll ever be like the main actor.
You were like a gangster or something, weren't you?
Yeah, they always cast me as like the mean guy, like the enforcer, or like the the bodyguards, or I don't know. Maybe I work. Well,
come
out
on, man! You're like the driven dude. Of course, they googled you.
I'm the old muscle guy that's cracking skulls.
We're gonna take a hard left, and we can take this wherever you want to, because this is a very personal question. But I've known you for a few years, and I don't know the answer to this. And this is something I'm genuinely curious about with you. You talk a lot about making an impact, and you know, leaving a legacy, and so forth. What is your spiritual beliefs around why we're so freaking deep? I'm like gangsters and comedy.
Get
I'm
all,
not
all
like
deep there.
Seriously, okay. I think about this all the time, because there is an element of why I'm so drawn to creativity is there's an element of detachment where you kind of deny a little bit of yourself, your ego, and you kind of go into this other space, which for me is a very kind of spiritual, interesting world. And it's been easier for me to conceptualize, like, you know, why we're being able to marry why I think we're here with my creativity. Because when I realize the reason we're here for me is to make a difference in this world, it doesn't really matter how I'm perceived. And that's how I marry it. But I'm also an overly deep, weird person. So maybe you don't have a lot of spiritual beliefs around this stuff, but I'm just curious because I've never talked to you about it.
Spiritually, I grew up somewhere in between Buddhism and Baptism because of my mom being Japanese and my dad being Southern Baptist. When I was a kid, we would go to Southern Baptist Church. It was only one in that town. And I listened to the sermons on hell and damnation, and that every other form of religion is going to hell if they're not Baptist. Like, they were very strict back then. This is in the 80s, right? And so I also learned back then that small town churches are kind of rife with just a lot of corruption. You know, we saw the main minister back then just doing a lot of things that were kind of shady or things that we would just disagree with. Yeah. And my dad was aware of that. And he started to realize, like, we're just going to pull back from this church. He goes, like, we enjoyed Sunday school and things like that as kids. But as we kind of got in the junior high and early high school age, he kind of said, you can go if you want to, we're not forcing you, because he started realizing, like, there's a lot of corruption in this kind of stuff, right? And I still think the Bible is the best personal development book that's ever been written by man. And I think that it contains a lot of things that are based on positive core values and reading people and learning how to navigate your life. I enjoy the story aspect because as a kid, you're learning things through stories and you remember the stories.
Totally.
And I don't think of these things as a lot of realistic happenings. And one of the things, me being kind of a maverick and kind of a rebel, even as a kid, is I would question things that happened in the Bible that were stories. And I hated the answer of, well, you shouldn't question the Bible. You shouldn't question these stories. It's just the gospel. It's blasphemy. If you just question anything, it is what it is. And yeah, and you did part the Red Sea and all these things, like these things that are fantastical, like miracle things. Like, are you sure that really happened in real life? Because a man wrote this story and it's kind of a cool story.
Totally.
Meant to teach us a lesson, but I don't know if it really went down just like that. And so I hated not being able to question things. And I think that's human nature, is we should be allowed to question things, especially if we're curious and need the answer, other than saying, because I said so, right?
Mm-hmm.
So on the Buddhism side of things, it's all grounded in nature and honesty and loyalty and very nature focused and live and let live and peacefulness and all these different aspects. And so I'm very fascinated with animals and nature and trees and all the different things I get to observe in nature and miracles that happen daily in nature. Like, you just see things, you're like, that's a miracle that exists. That's a miracle. When I see a bird that's colored with this cool patterns and bright colors, like, that's a miracle that bird exists like that. Like, how would you explain that? That's like someone painted that with a brush, right? And so I've kind of always gone in between of those kind of things. And yeah, I used to work offshore. I'd bring the Bible, I'd read things in scripture, but I don't feel confident enough to quote Bible verses like out of memory.
Yeah.
And so I kind of stay out of that lane. But I think that if you are that person that's quoting that stuff and you have it memorized, it's no different than you quoting Marcus Aurelius or any other philosophers that you enjoy. I think that people just gravitate towards the Bible things that they like to quote. So content wise, I think that I don't know if it really applies to the content I create, because I just look at it as, what is my intention? And if I'm doing things for the right reason, then I'm just going to keep doing what I do.
Do you believe in calling?
I do. I do believe in calling. I think that everybody's got a different calling. My calling, even as a kid, I realized I like to teach people things. I like to be a teacher. When I grew up broke and my mom was a cafeteria worker in a public school system, and I got to know a lot of teachers, I always saw them financially struggling. Even though they love what they do, they were financially struggling. Yeah. I didn't want to put myself in that situation. So logic prevailed. And I was like, okay, I'll go be an engineer and figure out how to make 100,000 plus. And so I avoided going down public school teaching. I used to substitute high schools when I was in college. And so I think my calling is to be really excited about things topic wise, invest the time and energy into becoming proficient or an expert at those things, and then having that succession plan where I can teach those things to other people to ensure that they achieve success. So when you hear of a calling, it's, I'm a teacher, I'm a coach, but realize that this manifests not only in your job title, but whatever you do. So when I was a kid, we talk about skateboarding. I was a junior high. I loved to skateboard. I would go out there and just practice and master these things. And then I would teach my friends how to do it. So it was even as a kid, I was doing that. I was always teaching my friends all kinds of stuff. Now I just teach business owners how to start up and scale and exit their companies. Like even in engineering, in my corporate career, I was always teaching and mentoring the people that were less experienced or newer to the industry. I was always volunteering to do that. So I've always been a teacher. And nowadays I'm still a teacher. I just never had the job title of teacher.
It's been interesting for me to let go of how I define impact, because I resonate a lot when you say make an impact and difference in this world. I mean, I'm a servant at heart. I love people like you, and I want to make a difference in this world. And I grew up in a narrative that was fairly, very deeply rooted in like God's calling and making an impact and changing the world, and the world's dying and you need to save people and blah, blah, blah. And I don't believe that stuff anymore, of a way broader view, but it's interesting looking at your creative work, your creative expression, some of the kind of more playful sides to things, and wrestle with the quote calling on life to make a difference and make an impact, and making space for a yes and, not an either or, has been wild, and kind of reframing what impact looks like when you become more childlike and more playful and more experiential and more creative, because it doesn't sound as impactful as, you know, the way I viewed it before. And I'm curious how you wrestle with, these are some deep ass questions, and I'm not sorry.
I like these deep questions.
With someone who has influence and you have a voice in a lot of people's life, right? And yet you make space to play and be adventurous and creative. How do you wrestle with impact with that? Do you see that as part of the same game? Yes or no?
Yes, I impact people in a different way than other people. I think that, let's look at the business coaching space. Most business coaches, you log into Zoom, they talk about KPIs and let's look at your P&L and let's look at your balance sheet and let's look at things that we can carve out and keep the overhead cost down. And here's some marketing strategies that we can increase the top line. And here's how we create the valuation of a company, like very tactical, very strategic, very regimented stuff. Those are the people that are just diehard business coaches. They're not talking about your life. They're not talking about your happiness, your relationships outside of business. They're not talking about the struggles you're facing as a business owner, the internal things that we had to go through, the personal development side of things. And so I'm a combination of a life coach, a business coach, and an executive coach, because I generally deal with business owners. Once we talk about the business tactics and things that I love to talk about, when people are working with me, let's say 6 months into it, we're really having more conversations about life and sanity and what they would like to achieve for themselves on a personal level, as well as the company level. And I would say that 75% of our conversations are not about business. It's about life, about hard decisions, maybe dealing with difficult partners or difficult spouses or difficult people at work that they need to handle or manage properly to get the best output from them, or, you know, how do I talk about selling the company, and are people going to judge me? And, you know, this content creation idea, should I build a personal brand? And a lot of these things are based on people trying to find their calling, trying to find their purpose. But I think that that's impossible to do when you're stressed out and you're anxious and you've overcommitted to things that you don't even have time for yourself. Like, it's very difficult to find your true purpose and your true calling because you literally don't have time to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So what I help people do is to carve out that time for themselves, start to feel less anxious and less stressful, learn how to optimize their companies to create income without them always being operations and having to be involved 60 hours a week. And I want them to become happy. I like to, like we talk about people flexing material, I like to flex happiness. And people work with me because they aren't seeing enough happiness and joy in their lives and entertaining. And they're rarely taking vacations, which is unfortunate. And I live my life on vacation by intention, by design. And so they see that I'm the expert at that because I'm living that, and I can help them with all the other technical things. That's why I'm a little bit different as a business coach.
Happiness. What brings you happiness right now besides traveling?
What brings me happiness, you mentioned it in our last conversation, is like, do you get up and look excited, feel excited about what you get to do every day? I think that I've been in that situation where I got up and used to have to wake up with an alarm clock, and I just felt, oh, God, I'm going to have to deal with this today. Like, and it was like periods of months and months and months like that, where I just did not want to go do what I had to do from a corporate level. Or maybe it was just a supervisor that I had to deal with and, you know, walk on eggshells to preserve their ego so I didn't get fired, you know? So a lot of these things that people just tolerate is because they earn enough to tolerate these things. And it's like, that's not a good reason anymore. Our life here, our time here is very short. Yeah. Why would you go donate 40, 50 years of your life doing something that's not your calling? You're having to tolerate things. They pay you just enough to accept the problem and the stress. When there's a lot more things out there to make you happy. I mean, when we're kids and someone asks, Heather, what do you want to be when you grow up? What was your answer?
President of the United States.
You know, my mom used to say I could be the president of the United States because she was a big dreamer like that. And my response to her was like, because I grew up in the 70s and 80s, like, that's not enough money to get shot, because back then they were always trying to get assassinated. And so I was pretty wise. I was like, I don't know if I want to have that happen to me. So for me, it was a race car driver, a stuntman, or a fighter pilot, like adrenaline type, enthusiast type stuff, dangerous, high risk. I'm that personality. I always have been. And so most people don't say, like, I want to be an engineer when they're five. Most people don't say, like, I want to be an attorney. Like, maybe some weird kids say that, but a lot of the career choices that we get into later in our lives are because it was directed by what your parents told you should do, or your counselors told you should do. And maybe it wasn't your calling, or maybe you're led by money. Like, I wanted to go make six figures. That's why I went engineering instead of teaching. So there's different things that we get misguided. And you find a lot of times people are in their 30s, they start to realize, like, I'm making money, I've got a family, but I'm not happy. And I don't know why. Like, there's something, like, everybody says I'm winning and I'm killing it, but I don't have that. I don't feel that. Like, why, what is that? And then I'll ask them, what did you want to be when you were a kid? They tell you something completely opposite of what they're doing today. I was like, well, don't you think that has something to do with it?
Damn. I think I'm now rethinking the whole president thing. Like, what does that mean about me? I think I just like to boss people around and be in charge.
You're the president of the parody household.
You better believe it. You better believe it. Listen, I have a final question for you to ask all the guests. I want to talk about your Costa Rica event, anything else you want to plug, but thank you for caring about people. Thank you for being transparent and vulnerable and practicing what you preach. I've said it a million times and I'll say it over and over again. I don't see a lot of men in your position who have the confidence to do what you do. And it's refreshing and interesting. And as a creative at heart, I feel like I'm getting represented out there of people who are breaking the mold and doing interesting stuff. I just love you and Lisa a lot. I'm excited about seeing you guys in Costa Rica in a couple of months, which I want to plug super heavy here. What are we doing in Costa Rica? And if there's any reason why somebody should come, what would that be?
when Lisa and I were doing a lot of these different events as attendees, and eventually me speaking at a lot of these business and entrepreneurship events, we started to take mental notes of the things that we just didn't like about things, and the things that we enjoyed about things. And you and I have been to a few Lewis Howes events, and we really enjoy the format because it's entertaining and it's social, and there's a lot of activities that are going on outside of the stage. That was one of the things we wanted to make sure is when we put on events that we're not just sitting in some boring, stale conference room with crappy carpet and drop ceiling tiles with weird lights and sitting there for 3 days, 4 days, 12 hours a day with 30 speakers. Like, those kind of things wear people out. And as an attendee and even as a speaker, those do take a lot of energy and you just feel like you're trapped in a conference hall. And so we do not want that. We always want to make sure the backdrop of the events is something spectacular, that not only for the speakers to create some video content on their speaker reels, but also the attendees get to be like, this is different. It's a kind of a different scene. Like, they're not used to seeing. Yeah. We also realize that more than one day of speaking is too much. While it's cool to have a bunch of speakers and have the, you know, the media art with all the heads kind of photoshopped oddly onto a marketing thing that don't match and the lighting's off and some heads are bigger and some look weird. And it's like, those are terrible. Like, I will never make a piece of content like that. Those are terrible marketing things, amateur stuff. And so I said, okay, we're going to bring in speakers that are guests of my show, people that are in my network, people that actually care about people, that will come in, do their presentation and their expertise, but also share meals with us and go on hikes and adventures and do things with us. So we always have physical aspects and challenges like hiking. We've done whitewater rafting in Montana. We've hiked the River Trail, the Narrows Canyon in Utah. We've rented out a racing school in Arizona, and everybody got a full day of racing, like all the attendees. And we've done amazing things. We've seen Chichen Itza in Mexico. We've been to Portugal and toured all the castles and wineries. And so we like to take people on an adventure that's disguised as an entrepreneur business event, because business owners can still write that off. It's deductible as an education seminar. And it's a great networking opportunity, 5-star resorts. Like, we always do things at a really high level, and that's why our events are different. And so the one that you'll be speaking at is in Costa Rica, June 8th through 13th. And it's a 5-day event. Speakers are going to be there the last 3 days at the cool resort on the beach. And we're going to hang out and do some amazing things. And so if you guys need information and like to join us on that 5-day event, go to 365driven.com. That's my website, and you'll find all the information there.
Excellent. And that will be linked in the show notes as well. So get your little booty butts there, y'all. It's going to be a blast. If you like adventure, if you like a good time, if you want to change your life, need I say more? Linked up in the show notes. Tony, very last question for you. I want to know something that you are deeply questioning right now at this point in your life. And I'm talking like you don't have a hint towards an answer. You don't really even have an opinion about it. It's something you're just questioning that doesn't make sense. And it could be something deep, or it could be something really lighthearted. I always use the Taco Bell example. I have no idea why people eat breakfast at Taco Bell. It makes no sense to me. What is something in your life right now that you are deeply questioning?
I would say that's, I like science fiction movies. And when I think about all the things that are going on in this world, you still have to question, are we still living in the Matrix? You go watch The Matrix. There's a lot of perspectives in the first movie. The rest of them kind of got just compounded onto the first one. But the first one was the movie. And are we just living a simulation? Are we really experiencing this? Who are we? Are we a being that's walking around in the skin suit? Like, there's a lot of things that we don't know. Yes, I believe in spirituality, and there's a creator. And I believe that there's a reason that everybody exists. But what is the purpose behind all that? Why are we here for such a short time, right? And are we just living a visualization? Because think about this. We're looking at AI. We're looking at all these different technologies now. Man, some of those things are hyper-realistic when you see that a computer can create that.
I know.
You know, and it's like three-dimensional, and you're living in these metaverses and all kinds of things. It's like, what if the creator, the being, just put us into his virtual ant farm and we're all just kind of experiencing these things, but it's not real. So that's the kind of stuff I think about. And it's, here we are like thinking about this eclipse that's going by, and everybody's kind of going through, getting crazy about this eclipse that's coming through. It hadn't happened since the 1970s. We're just a little speck of dirt in the middle of this entire universe, and every star you see out there is another sunshine. And around every one of those sunshines, there's more planets and other galaxies and things and black holes and things that we can't explain. So why do we think that we're so high and mighty and we have everything figured out here on this one rock that's flying around in the middle of a universe? And so there's much greater things going on that we can't explain. I'm excited by the unknown. Even if the unknown is bad and it turns out negative and, you know, Martians come down and take over the world, like, I'm still excited by what I don't know. And I think that we live too much in a small bubble in life, in our world, in our day-to-day operations. But there's things out there much greater that we can't explain. And I hope that I'm around long enough to see more evidence and understand that a little bit better.
Well, that was the most deep ask question response I've ever gotten. You're like, what are we doing here in the galaxy?
What are we doing here, Heather? What are we doing here?
I love it. Why are I love it. And then we freaking
what they should be doing. Like, why are you hesitating? Why are you waiting on perfect time? It doesn't matter. Like, do it.
We get tripped up over these stupid stuff, like what people think about us on Instagram, when really it's all just a joke. Like, that's, you're missing the point. I get you. Tony Whatley, you're the best. Thank you so much for joining us.
Heather, thank you.